large nations is the struggle for sovereignty and independence, for self-determination, for their own development, self-government. Countries like Palestine, Yemen, Korea, Vietnam, we're talking about medium and small countries that have given an example of courage and fight against very poor enemies, such as imperialism and Zionism. In Latin America, we have a tiny country that is Nicaragua, which throughout the 20th century, with the people, started building a social and political leadership against this extremely powerful enemy that was the United States, obtaining a great victory in 1979 when the Sandinista Revolution came to power.
Cuando se instala en el poder la Revolución Sandinista.
Raising the flags of Augusto César Sandino, the leader, the man who at some point fought, even expelled North American imperialism and was assassinated from behind. That's how it is, how imperialism has acted. But these are moments, later superior moments, came of reconstruction, of construction, and Sandino's flags.
Y la bandera de Sandino, la bandera del sandinismo.
The flags of Sandinismo have marched like a cry for freedom, sovereignty, independence throughout Latin America as a whole. Leading from a small country, it has shown that profound transformation are possible, not only necessary, but possible in this case, national and social liberation. And basically, that is, we are standing on our own feet.
Decir, estamos parados en nuestros propios pies.
Nicaragua is a small country. Today, it borders 7 million inhabitants. But there's something about it that for some is a blessing, and others might consider it a curse. It has two ocean outlets, the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean Sea. And that condition makes imperialism always set its eyes and want to have the prisoner and under its direction. I refer to U.S. imperialism. Hence the constant aggression and military, multifaceted economic corruption to destabilize the country. Because clearly a country with these two aliases, two organs, is very important from a geopolitical, geostrategic point of view. Since that allows a very important military point, and also for trade, which is fundamental. This makes imperialism very active.
Esto hace que el imperialismo esté muy activo.
In 2018, and the current government of Daniel Ortega faced a coup, activated a number of terrorist elements and some former leaders, including from the Sandinista movement, who were ideologically and politically disgraced, who had fallen into the trap of buying the model and the orders from the United States, and that they even received large amounts of money, as has been shown. However, the government of Daniel Ortega continues to be an example of construction and social progress in Latin America. Today, it has 104 large hospitals, 143 health centers, free education, free health, national independence, and also, why not say it, at the international level, today it is on the right side of history. That is, entering unity and in alliance with those who are seeking a multipolar world, such as Russia, China, Iran, and other countries. Nicaragua today is on its feet. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes.
I am with Gabriel Archie. He has a bachelor's degree and is ambassador of Nicaragua in Chile. He used to be a student leader. At the same time, he was a convicted revolutionary who fought on the Sandinista front in very difficult moments. He has also some internationalist missions. You're very welcome, Gabriel, to our program, Black and White.
Muchas gracias, compañero.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. It's a great honor for me to be on this show, precisely when we are on a day of the 128th anniversary of the birth of the great General Sandino.
Please explain to us a little about the importance of General Sandino. His stature spans all of Latin America and even worldwide, even though he was a small man. But he had a tremendous heart that was the general of free men. That's how he was known. Tell us a little about him and what this anniversary means.
Sandino, como usted sabe, compañero Eduardo.
As you know, and the world will know, Sandino defeated the U.S. Marines. Nicaragua has been a country that has experienced constant wars, and Sandino rebels against the United States and wages a six-year war. The United States intervened and occupied Nicaragua. Sandino expels and defeats the U.S., and it is the first defeat that the United States had in Latin America. In the Pentagon, until recently, they had two flags of their defeats on the left and their victories on the right. Between their two defeats, there are Vietnam and Nicaragua. Sandino is a world icon for fighting for the national sovereignty of Nicaragua. It is a great inheritance that we currently have. It is interesting that Albert Einstein says about Sandino, "You are a universal general." Gabriel Mistral, the Chilean Nobel Prize winner, says, "The little crazy army." And the French intellectual says, "The general of free men." And coincidentally, we're happy because this legacy, this flag, we continue to hold high today.
How can we approach this legacy today? General Sandino's proposal for sovereignty, social justice, national independence, and the construction of a good society.
In July 19, 1979, a group of guerrillas led by Commander Daniel Ortega entered Managua victorious, following the legacy of Sandino. Currently, what is this legacy of Sandino? National sovereignty. We are a country that raises this flag of national sovereignty. And the new world architecture, in this new world composition, where the United States insists on maintaining the Monroe Doctrine, the doctrine of manifest destiny, the new configuration is this legacy of Sandino to have relations with all the countries of the world within the framework of respect for our national sovereignty.
A nuestra soberanía nacional.
Interesante. Ahora, dime.
It is really interesting. Now, how can you understand this pause that exists between the first moment of the Sandinista government after the triumph and its resumption? And this pause that was to some extent determined by the fall of the countries in the socialist orbit at the time. How is it reconstructed? Because it is very new that they had the ability to retake the government with an overwhelming majority, according to the figures.
We see it from this point of view. The first stage, the fight of Sandinista Front, has been long since Sandino. Then the fight in the mountains, which was very difficult, but we managed to win on July 19. We had 10 years with the construction of the first stage of the revolution, besieged by the U.S. We were just beginning to govern, and the government of the President Reagan began with a hostile policy and with a war of aggression, that even this war of aggression, we sued in the International Court of Justice, and we won it. Nicaragua won this dispute that we raised. So these 10 years of building the new Nicaragua where the U.S. ambassador was no longer in charge, where the Pentagon was no longer in charge. To say, vote in the United Nations like this, vote in international forums in this way. July 19 for us meant the independence and total sovereignty of Nicaragua. What happened? Let's say that in these 10 years, there has been enormous wear and tear. Nicaraguan society lived in war, this war of aggression. Commander Daniel Ortega made the decision to hold the elections even at war, because no one holds elections at war, and we lost it. We say that the people did not vote against the Sandinista Front. The people voted for peace, because there was social wear. However, later, there were 16 years of neoliberal governments. In these 16 years, the country totally regressed, and at the level of foreign policy, it returned to the U.S. dominance, at the level of social demands, at the level of the achievements that we had achieved. They were completely moved backwards. After these 16 years, there was no electricity for 14 hours in Nicaragua.
Perfect.
We will continue our talk after a break, and we will follow this question. Why was it possible to resume the Sandinista government?
Thank you very much, for sure.
I continue my talk with Gadiel Arce in this interesting interview about Nicaragua. We were talking about the moment when the plebiscite took place and the Sandinista Front lost it, and that it is explaining very well that rather than losing it, what the people voted for was peace, because Nicaragua was living a moment of very strong struggle and with material implications of consequences of the intervention of North American imperialism and the government of Ronald Reagan. Please.
De Ronald Reagan, por favor.
Perfecto.
Perfect. One piece of information is important. Many times the Sandinista Front is laid to be anti-democratic, and there is a series of lies from the empire that we already know. Referring to the democratic character of the Sandinista Front, when taking power by force of arms, handing it over by way of elections, later there were three periods, 1, 2, 3. Until in 2006, we retook power, we won the government. It is very important to mention that the Sandinista Front has always had the power because there was this relation with the nation, humble people, students, workers and peasants, and we will never stop this.
That's why we're talking about a real revolution, because if we do not lose contact with people, there is no problem. Everything can be recovered.
Commander Daniel Ortega said a very interesting phrase in the 1990s. We are going to govern from the base. Because one thing is to govern, and another thing is to have power. So the power is in the hands of the people. Even our slogan now is that the people preside. So these periods of neoliberalism passed, where health, education, housing, and electric light went backwards. We had a 14-hour blackout in Nicaragua, where the electrical matrix completely collapsed. In 2007, the people voted in favor of us precisely because we were three in the streets. Commander Daniel visited farmers and university students and went throughout the national territory, expanding the Sandinista Front, and he didn't step back. He was present in the worst moments. That's why the people voted in favor of us in 2007, and we started the second period of the revolution.
Etapa de la revolución.
Una etapa que también no es.
It was not actually a simple stage. In 2008, there is an incredible coup attempt with a terrorist act. Tell us a little about this and how you see the measures that the government of Commander Daniel Ortega had to take in defense of sovereignty, independence, and the established order within Nicaragua.
Okay, perfecto, hermano.
Well, what really happens in the second period of government? We built a new model of governing the country. It is a model that includes the government, the workers, and the businessmen. This model is with the origin of idiosyncrasy. It allows us to agree on these three actors in the governance of the country. The result is spectacular in the first years. We grew by almost 5%, and the country begins a path of peace that we have never had in history. Nicaragua begins with roads, health centers, universities in the countryside. It is no longer the illiterate Nicaragua, but rather a developing Nicaragua. Apparently, North Americans, the North American Empire, the European Empire, didn't like this model of governance, because indeed we were building the new Nicaragua that was benefiting the poor of Nicaragua. What happened next? The United States gives the order to the business community that was building the new homeland with us to get out of this model. The United States also gives the order to a small group of students and starts to play them. They begin to build a group of mercenaries in Nicaragua. Later in 2018, the role they give to these political movements is to create thousands of false NGOs, NGOs that were completely invented to finance this failed coup. In 2018, they were advancing with a matrix of lies, because this is very important to say, the matrix of lies that they were building at the level of social media. In 2018, they attempted a coup, deceiving certain sectors of our society. They rose up, and we, led by Commander Daniel Ortega and Mrs. Rosario, managed to defeat them. I have to be clear that we defeated the U.S. policy. Why? Because the U.S. was paying the individuals and financing the groups, and we have all the sources, all the data on the internet and how USAID paid these mercenaries. Nicaragua, like other countries, for example, Chile, takes care of its institutionality. The Latin American countries and the U.S. also take care of their institutionality. So we have laws. What we have done is simply apply our laws to these groups, and we were violating our laws. But in addition, the violation of our laws was due to the murder of Nicaraguan people. Dead policemen, murdered policemen lying on the streets. They were set on fire in the streets. These cops were burned alive. This was a policy of terror in this century. We were successful in defeating this policy of terror and with people's participation, which is the element that constructs the revolution.
Querido compañero.
Perfecto. Sí.
Perfect. But in particular, the nationality was taken away.
La nacionalidad.
Claro que sí.
Yes, that's right. The U.S. applies death penalty and kills those traitors who violate their sovereignty. In Chile, there are also certain laws. All countries have their own laws against the ones who want to destroy the peace of the people and society, the peace that is difficult to build. We simply applied the laws of a constitutional government that is our government to those traitors. There's a sum of factors for receiving money from abroad, for murdering the people of Nicaragua, and for obeying the mandates of a foreign policy. We have this kind of treatment from Sandino. Sandino was implacable with the traitors because there is no other way. One can have different opinions about political issues at the internal level, but we can discuss these differences among Nicaraguan people. But what was the history? Because the information is very important. The U.S. has wanted to have Nicaragua as a colony. Imagine, Eduardo, that the U.S. put an American president in our country in 1856, William Walker. William Walker had two main decrees. There were slavery and the English language officially. In this small country, the U.S. created all the war laboratories. They tested with the Nicaraguans, but Sandino rises up. And pay attention that there are loyal people like Commander Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo and an army of young people who stand up and say, no, here we Nicaraguans rule, and we set our laws and constitution, and we apply them to those people who threaten our peace and stability as a country.
Well, thank you, Gadiel. We have just a few minutes to end our program. The ties with Latin America, mainly because there are apparently progressive governments that have not been good with the sovereign government of Nicaragua. However, other governments are. How is this situation at the Latin American level? In a few seconds, please.
For sure, we maintain a global harmony policy of respect for international law, and this is what we demand from other countries. We respect them, and they have to do the same. And we are involved in this new world architecture in favor of peace and the development of nations. Well, dear friend, I want to thank you for this little interview.
Muchas gracias, Gabriel.
Thank you very much, Gadiel. We hope the best for Nicaragua in this episode of Black and White. It's a sign of friendship. Long live peace.
Encantado, Gabriel.
Viva la paz.
Eso es.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Degrees of Humility. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We understand that humility is the opposite of arrogance. We know that arrogance is highly disliked by Allah. We know that there are numerous verses and ahadith about humility and arrogance. The question one may ask is, are there any degrees to humility? Let's turn towards a saying of Imam Qasim alayhi salam to seek an answer. The Imam says there are degrees of humility. One of them is to understand one's merits and capabilities and to use them duly with a pure heart. A man like this should not behave with people in a manner which he dislikes for himself. He will repay bad deeds with good deeds, restrain his anger, and pardons men. And Allah loves the doers of good to others. So this is a narration of Imam Qasim alayhi salam in which he explains the degrees of humility. Just like we have degrees of iman, right, faith. Just like we have degrees of taqwa, right? When it comes to humility, some people are just bare minimum humble. You know, some of their actions, they kind of indicate that they're humble people. Others are better than that. And in terms of some of their actions, they do other things that complement those actions and create this feeling of comfort for the poor, for instance, you know, comfort for other Muslims. And Muslims they feel welcomed to approach him to seek help, right? This is also part of being humble. So there are different degrees of being humble, which we should study more about and inshallah try to inculcate it in our lives. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing about the degrees of humility. How many times have we noticed that people's greetings with the poor are different from their greetings with the rich ones? Unfortunately, even in masjids, even in Husainiyas, even, you know, you go and attend a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you see this happening more frequently than we notice, right? So this is very unfortunate. You know, this is a trait of the those who are the people of the dunya, ahlul dunya, that they look at somebody's wealth and then treat them based on their wealth status, right? In Islam, the respect of a believer is more than Kaaba, right? So now, that respect is not dependent on his wealth or richness status, right? If anything, the respect of a mu'min is dependent on the level of taqwa he possesses, right? But unfortunately, in materialistic societies that we live in, things are upside down. We notice that people, they are respected because of the type of car they drive, based on the house that they possess, based on their job title, for instance, based on the number of degrees they have, based on their, I don't know, so many other factors like, you know, the type of phone, especially when it comes to youth, the type of phone that they're carrying, you know, so on and so forth. Divine values, unfortunately, have disappeared from our societies, even within Muslim circles, right? Imam Ridha alayhi salam says, the eighth Imam, anyone who greets a poor Muslim in a manner different from his greeting a rich one, Allah will be angry with him on the Day of Judgment. Look how explicit the Imams are in guiding us. So let's inshallah try to respect the poor, be humble in front of poor, and you know, those Muslims who are less fortunate, let's try to help them out and be respectful towards them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Trump Organization executives considered adding $144 million to Donald Trump's net worth based on a premium for presidential property in 2017. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. After journalists revealed several years ago that former President Donald Trump was likely not as wealthy as he claimed, executives at his company scrambled to justify new allegedly inflated valuations, volleying around ideas like applying a premium for presidential property to certain assets, according to evidence presented during Trump's civil trial in New York. The internal deliberations began after Forbes magazine revealed in 2017 that Donald Trump's Manhattan triplex, or three-story apartment, was about a third of the size he had long claimed, about 11,000 square feet instead of the 30,000 square feet that he had claimed, and thus was far less valuable. When Trump began reflecting the true size of the property on financial statements, its value dropped by as much as $207 million, according to a 26th of September ruling in the case that found Trump and others liable for fraud. A trial on allegations related to the ruling is ongoing. Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, testified on Tuesday that the difference was a proverbial drop in the bucket compared to Trump's net worth, claiming that when you look at the value of that apartment relative to his net worth, it is non-material. But in late 2017, Alan Weisselberg was particularly interested in unique ideas for finding extra value for Donald Trump properties, according to a testimony on Friday, 13th of October, from another Trump Organization executive. The executive, company vice president Patrick Burney, was shown a spreadsheet compiled that year in which the company proposed assessing a premium for presidential properties, calculating a series of reevaluations. 15% of premium for presidential winter residence, read one line under Mar-a-Lago. Another line for Trump's Bedminster Golf Club read 15% premium for presidential summer residence. The line for the triplex listed 25% premium for presidential personal residence. Also, the nine new valuations would have added more than $144 million to Donald Trump's estimated wealth. Ultimately, though, the idea was scrapped. But the episode is core to a case in which the state of New York is trying to claw back at least $250 million in what it calls ill-gotten gains. The state's argument works like this. Donald Trump, two of his children, and his company lied about how much properties were worth and how much Trump was worth in order to get favorable loan rates and insurance deals. By doing so, the state's argument goes, they benefited to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And New York Attorney General Letitia James claimed in her 2022 lawsuit those high valuations were also personally important to Donald Trump. This public desire to inflate his net worth was well known amongst his children and employees. Letitia James' office wrote in its complaint, highlighting internal emails and deliberations about publications that assess and rank society's wealthiest. Alan Weisselberg acknowledged during his Tuesday testimony another directive he gave to former Trump Organization controller Jeffrey McConney. That was intended to boost the value of certain golf properties. Simply say they are worth 30% more. That 30% premium was not disclosed in Trump's statements of financial conditions given to banks. On Wednesday, 11th of October, the court held testimony from a former Deutsche Bank executive who was involved in assessing loans to Donald Trump. He testified that the golf courses were unusual collateral for a loan that he didn't know had value, since the potential buyer's market for golf courses is particularly small. Still, he testified, I assumed that the representations of the value of the assets and liabilities were broadly accurate. Alan Weisselberg and Jeffrey McConney are also defendants in this case. Attorneys for the defense have argued in court filings that the company was within its rights to add so-called brand premiums to its valuations. On Friday, 13th of October, Burney testified about another moment in 2018 when the public's understanding of Donald Trump's wealth sent company executives scrambling. A Bloomberg reporter emailed Weisselberg and two other executives about its billionaires index. The company was prepared to slightly reduce its estimate of Donald Trump's wealth from $2.9 billion to $2.8 billion. The executive assigned Burney to research data that might combat Bloomberg's analysis. Burney fired off a series of emails to the company's bankers and others. Some, he said, may have been dictated to him by Alan Weisselberg, seeking information relating to the values of various properties. The matter, Burney wrote, was urgent. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Trump Organization executive Patrick Burney was once pressured by his former chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg to use an unrealistic metric to inflate the value of the Trump Tower. Burney testified to a court of law. Patrick Burney testified that he consulted a generic real estate report to determine a 2.67% capitalization rate to measure the value of Trump Tower. Despite an executive at real estate company Cushman & Wakefield recommending a higher rate, which would have decreased Trump Tower's value. When Alan Weisselberg and Patrick Burney discussed the topic in a Trump Tower restroom, Patrick Burney said he encouraged the chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, to use a higher, more realistic capitalization rate that would be more sustainable in order to maintain the building's value in the future. Burney testified to the court of law. "I think," he said, "just use 2.67%, Burney recalled. "I said I'm fine using that capitalization rate, but I'm worried that if we're only using 2.67%, the building is so old, next year there might not be a cap rate as low as 2.67. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, alleges that Weisselberg systematically rejected multiple valuations of Trump Tower in 2019 that would have lowered its value between $161 and $224 million. Also, Trump Organization executives considered adding $144 million to Trump's net worth based on a premium for presidential property in 2017, according to testimony of executive member Patrick Burney. The premium, which was applied to draft versions of Trump's financial statements, varied between 15% and 35% for various Trump properties, including his Mar-a-Lago club in Florida, which was described in documents as the presidential winter residence, according to materials entered into evidence. The potential adjustment followed a $200 million shortfall between Trump's 2016 and 2017 statements, after a Forbes magazine article prompted executives to revalue the former president's penthouse, state attorney said. "Who directed you?" State Attorney Eric Haran asked Patrick Burney about adding the premium. "I don't really remember, but probably it was Alan Weisselberg," Patrick Burney replied. Burney testified that the premium was eventually removed from the 2017 statement, according to a document that tracked changes made to the statement. He did not provide additional context about why the premium was removed.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his
Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about wudu based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Let me ask you this question, Sheikh Javid. You know, some chemicals or oils or ointments or whatever, such as, for example, makeup creams, right? Do they form a kind of barrier because some people, you know, are wearing it either because of their, I don't know, the purpose of beautification or, no, for some medical stuff, like, for example, the ointment that they rub or apply to their skins because of their skin problem. So do they form a kind of barrier for wudu?
Well, thank you for that very nice question. According to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, the person who wears such things, you know, cream or ointment or something like that, you know, himself should see whether it forms a barrier or not, because the religious authority cannot say that. He cannot say that this thing forms a barrier, that thing does not form it. He's not going to tell us about the manifestations of things we have questions about. Like, for example, he does not say that this cream is good, that's bad. Okay, that this one forms a barrier, that one doesn't form it. I think it's the religious authorities generally say that it's the people, the urf themselves, that should see whether something forms a barrier or not. And if according to them something forms a barrier or makes or impedes water from reaching the skin, then it should be removed, okay? Whether it's ointment or makeup or cream or something.
What about for medical purposes?
Of course, for medical purposes, again, you know, if you it depends on whether it, using water is harmful to your face, to your body or not. If it is harmful, then there is another way you can go for. You can make a tayammum in the event that water is harmful to your, to your body, to your health.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, Sheikh Javid, you know, in some countries like India, some men apply oil to their hair.
Yes.
Right?
You're right.
So what's the jurisprudential law about this, and how should they go about it when they are making...
Well, it's very common in countries like India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. I have myself seen a lot of men applying oil. And it could be olive oil or something, maybe. And the oil is applied to the hair. We need to understand that it's not necessary to wash the hair, whether it is in the while performing ghusl. And it's also not necessary to cut your hair short to just let your finger go through or touch the skin. In other words, the oil does not form a barrier when as long as it's on your hair. Because you just, what is necessary is to make sure that your fingers while wiping your head reaches the scalp, okay? Mm-hmm. If your wet fingers reach the scalp, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just push your fingers through your hair and pull them down. And the oil which is there, which you have applied to your hair, will not form a barrier. It will not make a problem.
You mean the purpose of wudu is not to make the hair wet?
No, not at all. So
only the scalp.
The scalp
needs to be wet.
You know, it's not necessary to make water reach the scalp.
Mm.
What is important is just make your fingers touch with your wet fingers, okay?
Mm.
If a part of your fingers come into contact with the scalp, that's enough, you know?
Mm.
That's called wiping.
I see.
You are not supposed to wash your forehead or make a lot of water reach the scalp. That's not necessary.
If somebody has a lot of hair on his head.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah,
Long hair or wavy hair or whatever, they have a lot of hair and it doesn't allow the wet fingers of your hand actually to be rubbed from top to bottom of your head. So is this wudu, this kind of wudu, valid?
Yeah, we do know that, there's no problem in having a lot of hair. Even the prophets had long hair. Ladies have long hair. You know, it's not a problem. So the Sharia, Islamic Sharia, never tells you to keep your hair short, okay?
Mm.
What is important is to keep your hair tidy and clean, okay? So, again, I'm saying that according to religious authority, it's not necessary to wipe your head from top to bottom.
Mm.
You can do it vice versa. You can wipe your head from the bottom to the top, you know, that will allow your fingers to reach the scalp.
I see. Okay.
And sometimes you can just divide your hair. If you have your hair, thick hair, which does not allow your fingers to go through, you can divide your hair before making wudu and just wipe and the very middle part that's divided.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions. Allah, yeah, Allah.
guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program and shared with our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about wudu based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, some people are wearing or using and applying collyrium, kohl, henna, and the like of those things. Do they are they regarded as impediment, you know, to the water reaching the skin?
Yeah. To my surprise, you know, I sometimes see a lot of Shia Muslims having the same problem. They keep wondering as to whether henna or collyrium or, let's say, things like that form a kind of barrier or not. Mm. According to all religious authorities, as far as I know, as far as I've investigated, none of the religious authorities have said that henna, for example, forms a barrier. Collyrium, for example, forms a barrier. They are just dye. They you know, they just dye your hair. Keep the ingredients are gone. There's no substance left. So as long as there are no solid substance left on your hands or on your feet, and there's just the color left on your skin, there's no problem. Your wudu will not be affected, your ghusl will not be affected, so you don't have to worry.
Mm. What about a synthetic color that some people apply to their hair, like women, for example?
Again, there's no problem because the substances are washed away. You know, once you wash your hands, there's nothing left on your, you know.
I see.
It's just like something we call it maybe tattoos, you know, that the tattoos, there's black color on your skin left. But it's done, the color goes under your skin and it will, and it does not, you know, form any kind of barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So you rest assured that your wudu is in order, your ghusl is valid, and you don't have to worry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, actually, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei about wudu. With me here, our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Thank you for joining us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour: Israeli forces storm Shifa Hospital, the largest medical complex in Gaza, as the death toll from the 40-day onslaught reaches nearly 11,500. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing increased